So what he's saying is that when you know why the life of justice, why the just man's soul is in harmony, and man's soul is in disharmony, then you know and you understand what justice is, and you move towards the just life for its own sake, because this must be, you understand that this is the correct life of man. So what he's saying is that the correct life is based upon an intrinsic knowledge of what is good, and once you have a knowledge of what is good, and you know, in other words, if a person, for instance, understands the human soul and knows that the human soul could be in disharmony, then he sterilizes and he sees that in this case, if the person is drawn to the ideas, his life is in harmony, his soul is in harmony, he knows that this is true, then he knows that the righteous must have their reward simply because the way the condition of their soul is what gives them the reward. If a person, now the person might die tomorrow, that's true. There's nothing out there that's going to say that if your soul is in harmony, you're not going to have a mishap. There's no guarantee for that. The Torah never, ever gives a guarantee to anybody on anything like that. The best example, of course, is the life of Jacob. Look at like no one's going to be more righteous than Jacob. And Jacob had a very, very difficult life. He had 20 years working under Laban. Then he made the money. He had the success. He knows he has to face Esau, who's about to kill him. He gets out of that. His daughter is raped. He gets out of that. His and then after that happens, then what happens is his favorite son is presumed dead. So this is the most righteous of men. So the Torah never says that if you're righteous, you're going to be guaranteed a good life. That is not what Torah is all about. But Torah does say that if you understand what is good and you understand what a harmonious soul is and how when you live according to Torah, the soul is in harmony, you have to do it because that is the only thing to do. That's the only rational thing to do. And that state of the soul where harmony is the greatest reward in itself. That is the reward to have such an existence. What God has in store for you in your life in terms of individual events, that is not the thing that should move a person. If you want to try to do that, that's where he says you're just going to be living in illusion, because the type of guarantee or security that you have in your life can be broken down. And the only way you could live that kind of a life is by denying the reality and the possibility of the breakdown, which means that you are of necessity in conflict and you must be unhappy. That is King Solomon's point. So King Solomon is saying that the only way to comprehend justice is to understand the perfection of the soul and why the soul is in harmony when it lives the Torah life. Okay, let's take a look again at 8:12, where he says over there that he says the sinner can do evil hundreds of times and have a lengthy life. And then he says in the very same verse, but I also know that it will be good for those that fear God. And in the next verse he said, and good shall not be for the wicked, and he will not have lengthy days. It will be like a shadow. Okay? So what does he mean? He means, it sounds like a contradiction in the same verses. What he's saying is, it depends. If you're looking at the externals, at external events, if that's what your ethical system is based on, then you're just fooling yourself. The evil man can be very successful and can have a very lengthy days physically, yes. But in terms of a harmonious soul, that's impossible. So that's why he says, and I know, he says, that the evil man will not have lengthy days, meaning to say any days of lengthy days in terms of quality. He's physically alive, but what good is life? Life is only good if a person has no happiness. His day is like nothing. It's like his entire life is like a shadow in terms of the good times in his life. Shadow. They're practically nil. So there, he's showing you that the only kind of life that can give man that is a man any kind of worthwhile existence is not based upon the externals and the events. The events God doesn't guarantee any kind of anything that has to do with events. All he tells us is he teaches us what is intrinsically, logically, the happiest life and the state in which the soul experiences the greatest joy, and that's through the knowledge of Torah. So there's where he's making inroads already into what the proper life is. But there are a few points that are left which are extremely important. At this point, I'd just like to mention what I said before. Why in the prophets you always have the woman is used in two different ways. One way is the evil way, which means the evil woman, which refers to the instinctual life. And the other way, the same idea of a woman, is used to represent the greatest life, and that is the life of Torah. And the reason for that is because the psychology of Torah is, and I may have mentioned this before, the psychology of Torah is that it's the same energy source used for the instinctual, which through knowledge is diverted to another course where it is used for knowledge. So that's why the parable that the prophet uses is the same thing. He uses a woman, but there's good and there's bad. Meaning to say that this same energy, which can be directed towards the evil, towards the instinctual, can also be directed, the very same energy can also be directed towards the highest life, which is the life of Torah and knowledge of God. So that is why it's extremely important that the prophet chose that. Because what the prophet is saying is it's the same energy source. This psychology crops up a lot in Torah, that the same energy source can be used for both. And the Torah believes that a very evil person also has the capacity to be a very righteous person. It's just that the energy is being directed in the wrong path. It cannot get out of the instinctual. But if that person could remove himself or herself from the instinctual life, they would be able to be extremely righteous. There's such a thing as a great soul, a very evil person who is it cannot be just a nobody. It's not an average person. It just has some kind of greatness to it. It's a high energy soul, but it depends where the energy is traveling. If it's traveling to the instinctual, then they will be a great evil person. Whereas if it's rerouted and directed towards Torah and towards knowledge, the person will be a great person. That's why I use the same example as mentioned before of the woman. And that's a part of the answer over here as well, where he's trying to show you what the good life is. Now, the good life has to be the life in which the energies of man is consumed. Because if you don't consume energy, then you're not going to have a good... Most people find that the greatest difficulty in life is they have nothing to do. Why do they have nothing to do? They're bored, especially people that retire. They find that the greatest danger they face is nothingness. In other words, they have to constantly be doing something. Just spoke to a relative of mine that retired. The most important thing for them is not to be alone at nighttime, because then they become depressed because they have nothing to do, so they always make sure to go out at night. People's greatest fear is to be alone with nothing to do. The only way a person can be happy is if they have the capacity to utilize their energy. And that's why the Torah teaches us that, and King Solomon teaches us as well, in Ecclesiastes actually, that you must from early on learn to channel that energy from the instinctual into the world of ideas and knowledge. If you do that, then you'll have an outlet for your energy, and you'll always be able to enjoy life. That is the greatest enjoyment in life. To channel that energy to the world of thought, to the world of Torah thought, to the world of ideas, and ultimately, of course, to the knowledge of God. So that's why it says in Ecclesiastes that you must remember God in your youth, because you have to start that process if you want to have a happy life. But whenever a person starts it, it's always good. It's never proper for a person to say, well, I'm too old, I'm not going to do it. You could always do it, but the earlier one starts, the better the better chance they have. So this is part of, this is an essential part of his answer: to recognize wisdom and knowledge, to love it, to be awed by it, to be attracted to it, and to utilize one's energy in that manner. That's when the soul is in harmony, because all the energies are drawn from the instinctual into the world of wisdom and knowledge, and they're satisfied over there, and that's what gives the person happiness. But, of course, he is not finished, because there are certain threads that are still loose here that he hasn't really taken care of. And I would like up those points now. You take a look at 8:15, okay, where he says, "And I praised happiness because there is no good for man under the sun but to eat and to drink and to be happy." Okay? Now, over here, again, this is a contradiction to what I said before, that happiness does nothing for a person. But what he's saying over here is, in the context of his answer, he's saying like this, that a person should not live for big goals. There's no big goals out there. The big goals out there are all illusions. Greatness, success, all these things are illusions. A person should live for the enjoyment and the beauty of knowledge, and they should enjoy, be able to enjoy the temporary and the immediate. That's an extremely great attribute, that a person can enjoy. The great scholar is an individual who is capable of enjoyment, okay? And he doesn't have the depression that follows from the person who is hedonistic. See, the hedonist has a depression, because the hedonist really is trying to get anything out of eating and drinking. But that's not possible, so after his enjoyments are over, he's in depression, because he feels, what did I get? What did I gain? But the perfected individual puts most of their energy into the world of thought and knowledge, and that which remains, they enjoy the moment. They enjoy food, they enjoy the drink, they enjoy momentary pleasures, and this is considered a great thing in the eyes of in the Torah system. A person that cannot enjoy himself, the Jerusalem Talmud says, is considered basically sick. I mean, a distorted individual, an unhealthy individual. The great scholars of Israel were always able to enjoy the moment. The Talmud says that when they used to go to a certain place where it was very delicious, they used to enjoy eating the fruits, and they would enjoy a certain amount of wine, which is considered good. The momentary enjoyments of life were attainable to the great scholars because they recognized what those moments are. Just moments. They're not something you can't, if you're going to put all your energy into that, you're going to wind up into depression. If all your energy, most of your energy, is in the area of wisdom and knowledge, then as a side dish, as a complement to that life, the little pleasures of life are something which one should enjoy. And if one doesn't enjoy them, then one's away with their way of living. Okay? And this really is a model, a Torah model of a personality, which, again, is not to be found in the religious sphere. This is a Torah. Torah is unique in its system. And this concept that a person should enjoy the moment, that's the idea of enjoying wine and enjoying good food, that's what he's saying. He's saying the only thing that's good for man is to be happy and joyous and to eat. He means not, as he said before, as an essence, but as a complement to the good life. The good life demands that a person should be able to enjoy the moment, momentary enjoyment. That's what he's saying over here. Okay, that's a component of the good life, and it's actually a sign of the good life. The person who has the life of Torah can enjoy himself, and this is a life. Okay. Now here we come to something that is another important component of the good life. You have to put it together piecemeal. Okay, he says, and again, it's in 9:7, okay? He says, "Go and eat your bread with happiness and drink your wine with a good heart, because God has accepted your actions." Okay, now this is a very important verse. It sounds like a continuation of what he said before, and it's true in a sense, because he's saying that you should don't put stock into these illusory kind of lifestyles, the great empire builders, you know, the hedonistic life. Don't, none of those things work. But he's saying like this, enjoy your bread, enjoy your wine, drink your wine, have momentary enjoyment. He says, because God has accepted your actions. What he means is like this. You see, one of the things that he didn't handle up to this point is the need that a person has for a kind of a stamp of approval on his life. Every person, you see, up until now is to go for the big stuff, the main thing, the attraction to knowledge, the enjoyment of knowledge. Okay, then he has the complementary enjoyment. There still is one part of man that's not satisfied up to this point. And that part of man is a person cannot help but think about himself or herself. It's impossible not to do that. Most people are really self-absorbed. That he's against. Because when a person's interested in knowledge, you're not thinking about the self. You're thinking about when Newton is thinking about gravity and equations, he's not thinking about himself, and that's why he's happy. The happy man is the man that's out there looking at knowledge. He's not looking at himself. He's away from the self. He's into something outside of himself. Okay? This is the idea of the Torah life. Our life and our society is totally self-absorbed. People want to enjoy life. What they want to do is enjoy thinking about themselves. This is an impossibility. Cannot be done. You can never be happy that way. So happiness is going into wisdom, which is going away from yourself. Okay? The scholar, the Talmudic scholar, is interested in solving the questions and the difficulties in the Talmud, in the Halacha. This is what his mind is preoccupied with. The problems, you know, questions. He's in the world of problem solving, the thought world, not into himself. He knows, on the contrary, he tries to avoid thinking about himself. But what King Solomon says is, you cannot deny the fact that at some point, I don't care what kind of a scholar you are, you have to think about yourself and think, you know, and a person wants some kind of approval for his lifestyle. Where do most people look for that approval? They look to their fellow man. That's where they try to get their approval. From their family, their friends, the society, and depending on individuals' needs for this kind of approval, the circle will be determined. Some people are happy with a small circle. Sometimes one person can be an individual's whole world. All they need is the approval of that one person. Sometimes, most of the time, it's not enough. You need a few people, you need family, friends, recognition, and it goes to the point where people want worldwide recognition. A person has a need for recognition. Now, what do you do with that? That, if you're going to look for that, you're going to get caught again in one of his illusions because you're going to put in a lot of effort. It doesn't happen. When it does happen, it still doesn't give you the satisfaction. It's just a momentary satisfaction, and afterwards you have the letdown. So life is really a life of contradiction and strife. So that is not a good life. So how do you get that satisfaction in King Solomon's life? So there he says there's one way that a person can get the satisfaction of the stamp of approval, and it's not from man. And that is when he lives the correct life, he knows that God approves of that life. That's his approval. And that's where he satisfies that need of man to reflect upon the self and to have the approval. That has to be satisfied in man in order to round off the happy life. But what he says is, it must only be satisfied by the knowledge that God, the source of all existence, knows that the life you're living is the correct one. Nothing else. If it's man, then you're in trouble. Now, you have to know this is a very tricky thing because many people claim that they really are interested only in God's approval, but they really are interested in man's approval. So this is, it's kind of tricky. And there's a lot of deceit, especially a person fooling himself in that respect. I mean, all the religious movements where they try to convert other people to their beliefs and all the atrocities and horrors that have been done in the name of religion in order to get other people to convert to their beliefs is nothing more than the need for approval, recognition, the stamp of approval from another man. Because if they know that their life is the correct one before God, then they don't really need anything else. but they don't really believe that. They say that, but what they really want is the approval of man. That's why they will coerce others to accept their religious beliefs, and when they're unsuccessful, they're unhappy because they don't have the approval of man. And their belief system is shaky and insecure, and the only way they can get out of that insecurity is by having other people accept their beliefs. As long as there are other beliefs which contradict theirs, they're insecure. So I just want to make the point that this is an in-depth psychology, which means that what he is saying is that you must be satisfied. But in truth, the only thing that should satisfy a person is the knowledge that God knows that I am living the correct life. There's no need for anything else. Once you have that, that's what he says, God has accepted. Go eat your bread with happiness and drink your wine with a good heart, because you know that God knows that the life that you're living is the correct one, and that's all you need. You don't need people or anything, and if this is all you have in life, you have everything. Okay, so that is the answer to the question of what do you do with the approval needs of man, okay? Now, there is one more thing, which I'll take up tonight, which is extremely important, and that is, it follows through from this, in a way, that's 9-9. And over here he says, see life, meaning see your life, to be with the woman that you love all the days of your empty life. I'm going to explain to you what that means. Which he gave you under the sun, all the days of your emptiness, because this is your portion in life and in your work, which you work under the sun. Okay? Very difficult, contradictory sentence on the surface. Okay. Let's take, what is the main advice he's giving? He says, see your life with the woman that you love. What is this woman that you love? So again, as I told you before, the woman is always either the instinctual life or Torah. One or the other, because they're closely related to the psychological process of the way the energies of the human mind are dispersed. So he says like this. He says that over here, the good woman he's talking about, which is Torah, he says, make sure that you have life with the woman that you love, which means the Torah. Okay. Now I'm going to give the rabbinical interpretation of this. The rabbinical interpretation is that the word life over here means a means of life, which means making a living. And the word Isha, the woman that you love, is referring to Torah. And the other rabbis say that what King Solomon is teaching you is make sure that you could make a living, you can earn a living together with the woman that you love, means with Torah. In other words, Torah alone is not going to be enough. If you study, if you only have Torah, but you don't have a life, which means the physical means for life, which is earning the ability to earn a living, then you are not going to be successful. Okay? And this is a very important principle of Torah. The principle of Torah is that a person should be self-sufficient financially. Sounds like a mundane kind of thing. Really, why should that be a part of our religion, such an important part of our religion? It turns out it's one of the most important parts of our religion. That in Torah, one of the most important things is that a person should be self-livelihood. Doesn't have to be wealthy, and he doesn't have to amass large amounts of money, but he must be able to be self-sufficient and independent, which means he must know how to earn a living, a trade, a profession, whatever way it might be, but he must know how to do that, and he must spend time learning the skills of how to do that. Why is that so important? It's extremely important in Torah, because in Torah, if you take money from someone, it's not simply money you're taking from someone, but you must always desire the approval of that person. And not only do you desire that person's approval, but that person, since that person is giving you sustenance, which is really your life, and you're dependent on that person for your life, you must always be thinking in terms of how that person thinks, whether it's ethical issues, religious issues, any kind of thought that it might be, you're going to have to be concerned about him. You may have to lie to him. You may have to agree with him. You're not going to be a free agent anymore when it comes to the value system, the true value system of life. That's why the Torah demands and this is one of the big principles of the rabbis, is that a person should be able to earn his own living. If you can't, if you're not financial, the financial is extremely important, because financial means it is very tied to, you see, in the early part of human life, the person is in need of sustenance, and the parents give the child sustenance. It's a matter of life and death, okay? Earning a living is, in a person's mind, a matter of life and death. Your life, if you depend on another person, that means that you're not looking to God anymore, you're looking to this person. You're not a free agent, okay? You'll notice in the all the leaders of Torah were always independent. Moses said, I didn't take one of their donkeys. And the rabbis say, even when he had to go on a mission for their good, he still wouldn't even borrow a donkey. He was not paid by the people. He was self-sufficient. He was independently wealthy. And the rabbis say the prophets were all wealthy. They were independent people. Because, and when Moses chose the people also, they had to be men of means. They had to be self-sufficient financially. Because if you're not self-sufficient financially, that means you must look to make for your livelihood and for your life, essentially, then you're not a free agent anymore. So the Maimonides says, went so far as not even to take a gift from anyone, because they never wanted to feel that any human being plays a role in their physical existence. It's only God, okay? That's extremely extremely important. And if you remember in Samuel, before Samuel rebuked the people, he said to them, just like Moses did, he says, and now I want you before all of you, I want you to give testimony. Did I ever take anything from you? Did I ever borrow anything? Did I ever not? He said, I want you to, anyone that says that I did, testify right now. And then he rebuked them, because he knew that the people, if people are supporting you, they cannot really respect you, because they feel that you're a bored individual. And for the person himself...
Rabbi, we have 1 minute.
Okay. And for the person himself, it is also an impossibility to be fair-minded and just. Of course, in today's society, we don't really live up to the ideal of the Torah in terms of leadership. And that's why we have so few true decisions in Torah, because people, our own leaders, are being supported by others, and they aren't free agents anymore. We're certainly not on the level of what the Torah really demands. Sometimes you can't help it. Sometimes it's the best you could do. So it's the best of the worst situation. But we should realize that what the best situation is, even if we're not up to that situation. Okay, we'll stop here.